Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and joined by security practitioners Mike Thompson, Killian Engler, and Mike Buckby. There was an MIT MBA student that tweeted his classmates said that they preferred to get a medical diagnosis from a human instead of a machine, even if they knew the human's diagnosis was going to be less accurate. And I wanted to know from the Inside Out Security panelists, which would you prefer, a medical diagnosis from a human or from a machine, and why?
Hi, this is Killian. I guess I'll start it off. I would prefer a medical diagnosis from a human. The inaccuracy, it's something you have to deal with, but I think also there's a bit of bedside manner. Having a machine tell you is very cold and clinical. If something is not well, you might want a person to console you a little bit. And I guess there's always a possibility of hope as well, too. Maybe they did misdiagnose it, or there's something else, and it could be better than you expected. So I think maybe that little bit of uncertainty is a comfort, or could be a comfort.
This is Mike Thompson.
I'm inclined to agree that I would prefer a human. I understand the argument that probably a higher degree of accuracy from a machine. But to me, as someone who works with computers and software on a daily basis, I bump up against unexpected limitations all the time. You know, there's fringe use cases where the existing options or inputs don't fit your needs. So, you know, God forbid you have some sort of rare medical condition. What if the software isn't really designed to cover all your bases or look for the right things, or it may not be as in tune to the way you're describing your symptoms as a doctor who has real world experience might? You know, it's still ingesting certain predefined variables and data to spit out a diagnosis. So I like the idea that a human is maybe a little more agile, more flexible in terms of their options than something that might be rigidly coded into a machine.
This is Mike Buckby. Have either of you worked in a hospital or like with hospital software or like closely with doctors?
Nope, not me.
Yeah. So I used to work 3M HIS and before that with the Naval Medical Systems. And this is with doctor documentation software, and worked a lot with orthopedic surgeons actually in building out a documentation system, like as a developer and like product manager in that situation. And with that as a background in my own personal life, you know, having had a few really bad misdiagnoses, I would definitely take the machine diagnosis over the human one. And to throw us out there, like, you know, we talk about technology in lots of different ways. And I think, you know, people hear like a machine diagnosis and they think maybe like Watson or artificial intelligence. But I think if you actually look at the statistical data, there's been a lot of information that says even like a checklist of what to check and actually stick to is better than most human intuition, especially if it's updated with the latest findings and not the superstitions of whatever was in that profession from, you know, two decades ago or that medical specialty.
All I can think about when we talk about this is if you guys have seen the movie Idiocracy, where Luke Wilson goes to the hospital and they have all the little probes and they're like, no, put this one in your mouth and under your arms and in other places. And they're like, oh, wait, no, switch them all around. He starts moving them around. It's a really funny scene if you guys have ever seen it. If not, it's worth checking out anyway.
I've seen it. I get there's a place and a way to use technology in a way that helps and in a way that hurts. I don't think it's to remove the doctor or, you know, any healthcare professional from the system, but it's to use them as a tool that you wouldn't expect a surgeon to pick up a stone rock from the driveway and cut your leg open to reset your bones. They use these high-tech instruments and instrumentation, and everything's, you know, autoclave, so it's super clean, so there's less risk of infection, and all these different things, and all these techniques. In terms of diagnosis and that particular skill set, I think it's something where technology really could help.
We've been integrating our lives with technology for quite some time now, and it's really interesting how everything feels very impermanent. Things are very gray, and for instance, when there's a cyber attack, it can potentially be considered an act of war, but right now it's not. Or something even less extreme, where you buy a video and then a few years later it disappears from your library because the company where you bought your video from loses the distribution rights. And so I want to discuss some of these blurred gray lines today. So I thought our icebreaker question was a good start. But I want to start with the most dramatic declaration of all, where an article I found brought forth the idea of electrical grids or other utility systems being targeted. And that's where the most interesting part in that article said that there's a fear amongst those responsible in security that you don't want to tell other people where your weaknesses are at. And I just feel like that's pretty significant, because it's like, you know, you need help, but declaring so might put you in a vulnerable scenario. And so what do you think about this concern and the larger point of attacking a country's utility grid or voting systems can be potentially considered an act of war?
Well, there are documented cases of essentially industrial processes blowing up from cyber attacks. You know, Stuxnet is probably the most well-known, but there's also been sort of sabotage and leaked information that I believe led to a gas explosion in Russia a long time ago. And so these things are happening in some ways, and it's difficult to tell, like, what is the real difference between, you know, a cyber attack that causes, you know, a dam to go haywire and destroy itself versus a, you know, dropping a bomb on it and causing it to, you know, collapse as well. I'm not sure the method makes a ton of difference there.
Like you, Stuxnet is the very first thing that came to mind when this question was posed. I think maybe people hear that it was a virus and they, one, our view of that attack may be skewed as it was a potential enemy of the United States and maybe potentially developed by the NSA, that attack. But I think by most definitions, that would be an act of war. I mean, if that occurred on American soil, I don't think we would be so blasé about it. I think it's interesting to think that maybe there are things that have happened that haven't been shared because that further exposes vulnerabilities. So how do we, but I imagine if this attack was severe enough, then that's not staying under wraps. You know, if it's truly a devastating attack that would escalate to the level of, okay, this is an act of war, then that information probably isn't being kept secret. That's going to be in the news. It's not something that's going to escape conversation among NATO members. So I don't know. It's an interesting question, but I think when it's kind of like what is art or what is obscene, you know it when you see it. I think the same thing goes for an act of war. You know, there's a certain threshold and maybe you can't, it's hard to describe, but you can understand and on a visceral level when a cyber attack reaches that point.
At least for me, when talking about that, I think of it in terms of, you know, risk to potential human life. Or if you cause a dam to go haywire and it floods a town and it could potentially cost human lives, or if you shut down the electrical grid and it's winter and people could potentially freeze to death or starve or something like that, or you attack the water system so you can't get fresh water. Those could all be potentially imminent risks to human life. And I think that could be the threshold of it. Not to downplay some of those other ones, some more of the espionage things. If your centrifuge doesn't work, again, not to downplay it, and I don't know anything more about it than that, but you're not imminently risking human life at that point. And I think maybe that's the definition, or at least that's the way I look at it. In terms of the second half of the question that Cindy asked, if you think about sharing vulnerabilities, I don't think even as a person, as humans, I don't think that we like to admit our fears or our flaws or what we perceive to be weaknesses. So that's something that we, I think, as people struggle with. And in a similar way, there has to be a really high level of trust with your allies to be able to have a frank discussion about, hey, you know, our cybersecurity defenses are weak in this area. What are you guys doing to combat it? It's absolutely critical, but there is a lot of trust needed for that. And you know, NATO allies, we should be able to have that conversation or find a way to discuss these things in a way that maybe shields our interests a little bit, but can leverage the group as a whole, understand things that we might not see. So they might have a different perspective that we can leverage. And that's really the critical aspect.
Another cyber attack that sounded egregious was that British Airways had about 38,000 customer financial information stolen in a breach where a customer would click the submit button and the transaction would go through as normal, but that the attackers also got the customer payment information despite the fact that it was supposed to be a secure session. And when you execute an attack that impacts thousands of lives, where do you draw the line between you think you're safe, but then you're really not?
I mean, anymore, it seems like, at least for those of us living in the InfoSec space, you just kind of have to assume that everything you do online is probably going to be compromised at some point. And especially in the case of the British Airways one, these attackers really made a concerted effort to very specifically tailor their attack to their target and remain undetected. So they went and even got paid SSL certificates to maintain the illusion that even if you were looking at what you were connecting to, they used like B-Ways or something like that. So something very similar to a legitimate site, and used a paid certificate to try and avoid some cursory detection. So there's always that risk. And it's kind of disheartening a little bit, but it all comes down to we like the convenience of being online and being able to book our tickets or whatever versus going to the airport counter to buy them. So there's some level of risk that we have to accept. You know, people who are charged with protecting this data, it would behoove them to add defense in depth that we always talk about to try and avoid this as best as possible. But we have to kind of assume at some point that it is going to be compromised.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's much you could do from like being a vigilant and security-minded consumer to have avoided falling prey to this particular attack. I mean, it was very sophisticated. You know, unless you're checking who signed these SSL certs and then, you know, doing some intense research, like, you know, you're screwed. I mean, if you did business with British Airways, they're getting your number. So I agree. I think there's only so much you can do, and you just accept a certain level of risk. And now certainly on their end, I think that maybe there's some more monitoring they can do, looking for, you know, potential changes to scripts and things like that, unauthorized or unplanned. Maybe this could have been caught sooner. But from a consumer perspective, I think it's maybe sad to say, but we're probably past, until there's more secure payment technology, I'm not even sure if that's really feasible. You're just accepting a certain amount of risk to do business online.
People rail about like, oh, the size of web pages today. And you sound like, at least I sound like a curmudgeonly old man of like, when I was a kid, web pages could fit on a floppy disk. And now, you know, every website you go to has, you know, hundreds and hundreds of calls happening on it. And in this case, loading up lots of different JavaScript libraries. And this is Modernizer. So Modernizer is a very well-known JavaScript library that tries to, you know, paper over a lot of the different differences between browsers and have functionality that works the same across all of them. So it's very widely used. And so they added some extra lines to this, you know, otherwise uninteresting library. But, you know, what really happened is they were calling a domain out, a third-party domain that you think you're interacting with British Airways, and turns out you're interacting with something else. And this is, I think, a larger and larger security issue that's being dealt with mostly at the browser level, that there's other semi-related security issues around like a lot of things like cookies. And we're seeing the browsers becoming more and more restrictive of letting third-party domains other than the one you actually are loading up, actually issue, set, or modify cookie. More and more issues of like ad blockers blocking all third parties. So this is definitely something that they could have caught, and eventually they did. But yeah, it's tricky. I guess the real question to me, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this that I don't quite agree with the SSL certificate from Komodo and things and different issues. But how did this get in there? Like, how did this functionality really get put in there? Like, to me, that's the tricky part. Like, was this an inside person that put this in the development and pushed it out? Was it, you know, something else? I mean, there's so many weird different ways this could happen, and we still don't know.
Interesting. Sometimes it's not a cyber attacks, but we self-inflict harm on ourselves. And for instance, Killian sent this really interesting article on how researchers from Carnegie Mellon figured out how to transfer the style of one person's speaking tone to another. So you can have Barack Obama style can be transformed to Donald Trump. And so this isn't new news. I've heard of this a few years ago, but this technology is getting even more accurate, and we often talk about layers of security, and I wonder if we need a new layer of security of defense, or how would we combat this if it really became a serious problem of trying to spread fake news even further?
You know, we already have this issue with static images, and we have, you know, for 20 years plus now, the technology to, you know, Photoshop an image to make it look like something else is consumer easily obtained. And I think there's a general cultural, you know, recognition of that fact that, oh, this is something that could have been faked. And in cases where there is photographic evidence, a lot of it goes to, you know, the person and the circumstances and other things. And so we consider, you know, video better, though that's being taken out, and audio, and that's being taken out. So I think it's going to have to be the same thing, where there's a cultural reshifting of exactly how much we trust things. And, you know, hopefully we mature as a society and can make better judgments about who and what we trust.
One area where I just feel like a complete technology, like fearing Luddite or something, this scares the crap out of me. And I mean, I remember years ago, as I kind of saw the writing on the wall of where things were heading, and I didn't think it would come this fast. My mind was spiraling with all sorts of kind of conspiracy theories about how this type of technology, especially as like things like FaceTime and video conferencing were becoming, you know, something that people are more and more comfortable with and using in their everyday lives. Anyways, I just, to me, this just seems like area of research that we don't need to pursue any further. This doesn't need to get so cheap and easily accessible so that the average end person can fake high def video, whatever they want. What's the benefit to society other than Pixar can render a scene for $5 million instead of $10 million? Like, I just don't, I don't see how this is beneficial other than we're making something nefarious, easily accessible and cheap. And I realize I'm being kind of backwards and this is kind of going to happen either way. And I think Mike makes a very good point that it's society's responsibility to adapt to these things and be mindful and suspicious at the right times. But I just fail to see the good side of this personally. And I saw something recently. It was a YouTube channel that does deepfakes. And they recreated, well, I don't want to spoil a movie, but there was a recent Disney movie with a kind of someone CGI'd to look younger at the end. And it was pretty big in the news. Anyways, this person recreated that scene at home using deepfake technology, and it looked even better than the Disney version. Whatever was in the theaters that they probably spent, you know, millions of dollars of research on, this guy knocked it out on his home computer and made it look even better. So, and that, I don't know, it just, it blows my mind, and I don't like what's ahead of us with this technology.
Warner Brothers should have borrowed this to digitally remove Henry Cavill's mustache there from Justice League. I'm just saying, probably could have done a pretty good job.
The same channels also tackled that problem, actually.
But, I mean, Mike Thompson, I tend to agree with you. What I, you know, if I put on my little crystal, or put on my hat and put it in my crystal ball out here, what I see is this is going to be, well, to step back a second to Mike Buckby's point, I think right now, and I don't think it's controversial to say that society has trouble making those distinctions about what's real and what's fake to a certain extent. And again, as Cindy mentioned, this is a self-inflicted wound to a certain extent. So I think we struggle with that as a society now, and it hasn't even gotten as far as it possibly can get. And making this type of software available, I can only see doing way more harm than good. But on the kind of other hand, this strikes me as a, you know, this type of AI and machine learning is going to make us have a problem. And then we're going to flip it around and come up with the solution to the problem that we created in the first place. So I see people making money in some ways on both ends of this, the bad guys, the attackers, scamming people, using it to make fake things, and then the good guys turning around using this technology to try and catch it. So it's almost like an arms race in a sense, and I don't think anybody's going to win.
So one aspect of data we don't talk about a lot on our podcast is data ownership. It's another gray area. So in the corporate world, we say that data's owned by the company because they own the intellectual property, the organizational processes. But when a user is self-generating that data with the help of that company, or if a user buys a movie and the company in which you buy it from loses the distribution rights, or I remember when I was talking to Mike Buckby about how we upload our episodes on SoundCloud, and if they ever close their business, and we hope they don't, that all our work of uploading our podcast would be gone. And I wanted to hear your thoughts about data ownership. We haven't talked about that very much. What are your thoughts on mostly the user's right in their ownership of data?
So I think with this, this has been a problem that we've been facing for a lot of the digital age, where, you know, when you go and purchase a piece of software or a digital content, the companies really want to treat it like a long-term lease. Like, you don't actually own it. You're just borrowing it from them. And that's something that we've, you know, and this goes back to like Microsoft licensing and all the other good stuff, even in the Windows, whatever, 95 days. So it's a problem that we're still battling with. We haven't come up with a good solution. And in the article that Cindy, you're referencing, is Apple lost the distribution rights to certain movies. And so they pulled them from this guy's library, and he noticed. And in that case, the way that I look at it is basically theft of service. He went, you know, and Apple tried to indemnify themselves in their terms of service and all that other jive. But at the end of the day, he gave them money for this video. He wasn't renting it. He wasn't borrowing it. The generally accepted conceit here was he purchased it the same way that he would purchase a physical copy. So I think they owe him that money back. It's not his fault that they lost the licensing rights. He's in no way responsible for that. He trusted them to do the right thing. And that's the way that I look at it is, you know, there needs to be a certain level of consumer protection here.
I agree. I think refunding them purchase price of the movies is like a no-brainer solution. And it's not like it's a system that could be abused. I mean, it's pretty clear-cut criteria. Oh, you owned a movie that has since been, and it was stored in the cloud, and we lost the distribution rights in your country. It's not like people can, you know, somehow hack that system to get free movies for a while and not pay the fees. So just give him his money back. And I don't like this, I mean, the system problem in general. And I, as someone who owns some movies in iTunes, it makes me a little nervous. But I realize that I bought them out of convenience as well. There's a reason I stopped buying DVDs and Blu-rays, and it's because I live in a small New York apartment and don't want to have a dedicated machine to do that. So if I can just do it through my Apple TV, great. So, you know, I've already made some trade-offs for convenience. I don't like the idea that I could lose my media, but I would hope that Apple would right that wrong and refund my money should it happen.
You know, Mike, that's the other big thing, is that's the dream that they've been selling on us or selling to us forever now. And it's Apple and it's Amazon and it's Google and all those. Hey, trust us with storing your data. You know, we have these big server farms out here. Don't worry about, you know, backing up. We'll back it up for you. We'll keep it safe. And they've been, you know, largely very successful with that. I mean, if you look at people adopting Amazon S3 and Google Drive and all those other things, businesses and everybody else, you know, they're buying into it and people are, you know, experiencing good results for it for the most part. And I think this type of thing shakes some of that consumer confidence a little bit, is, you know, their kind of reaction to it. And it's minor. It's, you know what, even if it was a full price, ultra high def movie, it's $25. I'm pretty sure Apple can eat that for consumer confidence. So I think it's more damaging to their brand to have this kind of nonsense, especially as they're trying to get people to move to the cloud and use cloud services.
I think we should push back a little bit on this, only in that, you know, we're talking a lot about this. Apple should do this. I feel like Apple isn't the one to blame here. Like, they're taking it on the chin because they're the point between the consumer, but who, you know, took most of the money for the purchase was the company that actually made the movie and distributed it. And we don't know who that was, but if they pulled the movie, it wasn't Apple pulling it. It was, you know, this other distributor that's going through this.
Sure. I mean, the money's changed hands, but, you know, if you go and buy your DVD at Walmart, Walmart's not going to show up at your house and take it back from you because whatever the movie studio has said, you can't sell that or store anymore. They'll pull it off the shelf so they can't sell anymore. But in the same way, they facilitated that transaction. Whatever they did to get the movies, I think that's inconsequential in this case. There was some good faith between Apple and the customer. You know, whoever the studio was pulled it, but Apple should go after them to recoup the money. But that's not the consumer's fault.
Well, I'll agree with that. And I think this also took a slight turn from, you know, Cindy's starting point, which was that, you know, like with SoundCloud, there's a slightly different situation where what is your data and what is SoundCloud's, to me, at least, is a little bit mixed, where, or like YouTube is something maybe more people are even familiar with. Like you can put your video up on YouTube, but then people comment on it and they have all sorts of other things that are sort of surrounding it in the same way. Like on SoundCloud, people comment on it and interact with it and do things with it. And, you know, that tertiary data is kind of there. I'm still conflicted about that, the Apple stuff. I don't think consumers should be ripped off. I think they should have this, but it seems like we're putting the emphasis on the wrong spot.
Sure. So, I mean, kind of getting back to Cindy's point, and I'll talk about that. I think YouTube video is a great example. It's been put up there. It's been distributed. You'd think, you know, the actual video itself, whoever the creator was, would be the owner. All the tertiary data around it. I think, Mike, you're right. That's a little bit harder to discern. I don't think the video creator would own the comments or any of the other kind of surrounding things. I don't necessarily think it would be the content, you know, the YouTube platform either, who would be the owner on that. But again, it depends on what the work is. And it wouldn't necessarily be lost forever if that was, unless there's your only copy and your computer blew up or something. But,
well, I was thinking more about something like your subscribers. Like, there are a lot of YouTubers with like millions of subscribers, and they have a relationship with this audience and things. And they all have emails and accounts and things, but there's no good way to move that to another system if you decide, like, oh, YouTube's no good for me anymore, or I don't like this relationship. There's no portability to that.
I think that's an argument that is playing out publicly right now with some of the big tech companies and trying to solve that problem exactly. If you think about it, and I'm not taking sides or attacking anybody, but, you know, let's say you decided YouTube wasn't the right platform for you anymore and you wanted to move somewhere else. Where are you going to conceivably move to? You know, what other platform has that type of reach and the scalability? And there's a reason that YouTube is dominant, but it's very difficult to make that transition.
What I think is interesting here is we're kind of touching on opposite sides of an issue. One is, I'm uploading my content to some third-party provider. What are my rights? What are their rights? Versus I'm receiving content via a provider. Again, like, which side does is favored in this legal contract that's, you know, you've agreed to as part of the end user license agreement or whatever it may be, or the terms of service. So like we said, Apple kind of covered themselves and said, you know, we could potentially lose access to your media. And there's other platforms where you're uploading content and you're losing your rights. I think there's this gray area that comes with using any, you know, cloud service, where once it leaves a device you own and is stored elsewhere, your rights have changed whether you realize it or not. I remember years ago, there was an issue with Virgin Mobile. They had took a photo that was licensed appropriately with the right Creative Commons license from Flickr. I don't even know if Flickr's still around as a photo upload service, but once upon a time, it was, you know, the big one. And it was some kind of like shy, awkward-looking teenage girl, and they used it for a huge advertising campaign in Europe that was like, text your friends, virgin to virgin. I mean, this girl was humiliated as a result of her photo being used for this ad campaign, but she had uploaded the photo to Flickr, hadn't changed any, you know, default upload settings, and it was Creatively Commons licensed by virtue of it being uploaded, and she had really had no legal standing to make any claims otherwise. So I guess my point here is, and not just on the consumer level, but at on a business and enterprise level as well, just because a cloud service or some tech comes along that seems like it makes your life easier and does what it wants you to do, you may not realize what type of rights you're signing away by using that platform.
I mean, just to that point, to bring it back to security just a little bit more, you know, when organizations leverage some of these cloud platforms, it doesn't transfer the rights to protect that data to the cloud provider either. They're still responsible for protecting that data in many cases too, which is something I think a lot of people struggle with, at least conceptually, is that, hey, just because I'm not physically storing data on my server at my office and I'm using a cloud provider, it doesn't mean that I'm any less responsible for protecting that data. And I think we've seen that in a number of breaches as well, too.
Good point. To wrap up, instead of the tool of the week, I wanted to ask our panelists, I just came up with an idea to organize a live one-day online security and privacy conference, and I wanted to know what or who you would want to listen to in order for you to join the webcast.
So you want to know who we would like to have as like a speaker on this?
Yeah, or a topic.
I think in terms of a speaker, I don't know, I might be stealing Mike Thompson's thunder here, but I think Bruce Schneier would be an awesome person. He's such a huge name in the security world. And I remember in college, I read how many books of his about security over the years. That would be tremendous to see him speak live. I've never actually seen him speak at anything before, so it'd be really fun.
I think I would actually like to hear more about, you know, the DeepMind AI stuff, where just all the weird different things that can lead to. I know we talked about that some on the thing today, but, you know, my mind goes to things like right now, spear phishing is still something that happens where someone says like, oh, I want to get into this company, so I'm going to tailor this email to really look and, you know, work its way into this. And I always wonder about like, oh, could you actually apply that in a certain way that, you know, it would just automatically happen and 10,000 companies could have these, you know, incredibly effective, you know, spear phishing messages, or, you know, to be used in other different ways.
It's the one problem that people can't figure out how to prevent.
You know, one thing I was kind of talking with a coworker about recently, you know, there's a lot of money and energy spent on internal IT security, but increasingly with, you know, startups and, you know, it's kind of the modern workforce, there's a lot more working from home. I'd be curious to know some kind of best practices or like, you know, we talk about a layered security approach often when it comes to businesses, but what can a consumer do from a layered security approach to not only protect their own information, but their business information if they're someone who works from home? Like if a employee is connecting to corporate resources from home, what can be done on the home networking side to increase the layer of protection?
That's a good idea too. Thanks, guys. I knew you'd be able to help. Thanks to Mike Buckby, Killian Englert, Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you enjoyed our panel discussion, please subscribe to our show. You can find more episodes of the Inside Out Security Show on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, SoundCloud, and more. If you have a minute, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell others about the show. It helps them discover great discussions like we had one today. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye, Cindy.
Bye.
Bye.